Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on that zero emission future that we all hope for. Every week I get joined by one of the wonderful members of the team, and in a slightly unusual way of arriving, John has arrived. John, welcome.
Hello, I've got burn marks on my feet as I didn't have a calendar invitation for today, which is going to mean that I am winging this completely. How unusual.
Ooh, we love it when John wings it. He's actually pretending to ring it for the first time. He wings it every time. But anyway, more importantly than all of that nonsense, we are joined by, obviously, every week, innovators, pioneers and collaborators. And this man is an innovator par excellence, and a collaborator. I mean, collaboration is, it should be part of his job title because it's everything. We have got Faizan Ahmed from First Bus. Faizan, really big welcome to you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you very much for having me, and good to meet you as well, John.
For those of those people that have been under a rock for a little while, please tell us, Faizan, who are you and what do you do?
So I am the Decarbonization Program Director at First Bus. And for those of your audience members who don't know, First Bus is one of the largest bus operators in the UK. And dare I say, now, over the last couple of years, we're also very much getting established in the coaching business as well. So where do we operate as a bus operator? Well, really all over the country, all the way from Penzance in Cornwall up to Aberdeen in Scotland. And also, I think when people think about buses, they think about London and they think about the red double-deckers. And we are operating in London now as well, as of earlier this year, thanks to an acquisition of RATP in West London. So in terms of decarbonization, then, I think we're quite proud to say, I think we are doing very, very well at First Bus relative to the bus industry. We've got a fleet of over 5,500 vehicles, of which now already 1,200 are zero emission vehicles, and we're already on track to be at over 1,500 by the end of next year. So that's just the headline numbers, and then as part of that whole journey, and I'm sure we'll get into that over the course of the next few minutes, we've got very interesting initiatives such as repowering old diesel vehicles, such as we've got depot-based charging infrastructure, which we're allowing third parties to use as well. We've also pioneered gantry charging infrastructure in the UK. So it's not just ground-mounted, but it's like you can, the drivers can pretend to be a Formula One driver, press a button, and immediately, well, stick the charging gun in. So it's all happening at First Bus. It's a great place to be.
Wow. I mean, Faizan, you paint a picture of real innovation and real ambition and real collaboration. And I mean it genuinely, when I for context, everybody, I recently was genuinely privileged to hear Faizan speak at the Transport and Energy Fleet Electrification Conference Forum in Warwick, and Faizan spoke about this, and I immediately knew that we needed to speak because this ambition, where does it come from? Because this is no small investment, right? 1,200 buses already, moving towards 1,500 very shortly. All of the charging infrastructure that goes along with that. And this is not little 7 kilowatt tucked out the way on the back on a stuck on a wall somewhere. This is a complete rethink of your whole infrastructure. There's challenges around energy. There's challenges around the chargers. There's challenges around the vehicles. Where does this ambition come from? Who? Is there a single person that you kind of go, that's the person that has led this, or is it a company-wide? How has it come to market? And obviously, you're playing your part. So tell us about it.
Yeah, I'm playing my part, and I should acknowledge I've been in role a little bit, 2 years and a little bit. So I think much of the vision and the initial steps and the ambition, I think, was it Isaac Newton who said, if I've looked further than others, it's because I've stood on the shoulder of giants, and I would very much say that in my role as well.
Nice.
In terms of... our North Star, and I think a few years back, was we want to get to a zero emission commercial bus fleet by 2035. And if you think about that, that doesn't sound that ambitious, especially when you think about vans, and that's what most folks think, because you're looking at a normal 5 to 7 year lifetime. But in reality, for the bus industry, where you've really got buses which last 15 to 20 years, well, putting a line in the sand and saying 2035, in reality, that's ambitious. And then all what we're doing really is just working backwards from that target and saying, well, what does that really mean in practice, and how do we get there, and where does the investment come from? And yeah, just putting that into practice. And we do have to acknowledge that I think the bus industry as a whole, we have been very grateful for government support as well in terms of, well, catalyzing this initial investment. But that being said, it is still support. And I think from a First Bus perspective, over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, it's been an investment of over £300 million of private capital into electrifying buses and also getting infrastructure across the board, across about 15 plus locations in this country.
That's huge.
And we're doing it because, I mean, we're not a charity, we're a business. And we just happen to be looking further and seeing, well, this is good for business. It's going to be good for our customers. It's going to be good for our employees and good for shareholders as well.
If you operate a fleet of cars or vans, you'll know electric is the future. Transitioning to EVs can appear daunting, but with Europe Car, it's effortless. Our long-term EV rentals eliminate the upfront costs, contract commitments, and uncertainty. Instead, you'll get total flexibility, a wide choice of cars and vans, and Europe Car's expert support. So, make the switch without the stress and experience Europe Karma. Search Europe Car Business.
Faizan, it's good to hear you shout out government there and their part that they have played. I was in the Scottish Government in 2010, 2011, when we created the Green Bus Fund, which was the first time that electric buses were funded and hydrogen buses were funded for Scotland. And First Bus has always been at the cutting edge of new developments. You were the first company to say, hydrogen buses? We had no electrolyzers. We had no way of creating green hydrogen. We had no hydrogen buses. And yet you guys were there with Stagecoach saying, yes, we want to try this. You have, as a business, an innovative and forward-thinking management structure and culture which drives change. It literally drives change. It doesn't just happen by accident. How do you keep the energy going? Because there's a lot of people saying, this will never work. You know, electric buses, they're a fad. Hydrogen, that's dead. But you keep going. Is that a personal thing as well as a cultural thing? Or is it just you're driven from the top and you're told to get on with it and you do?
I think over the course of the last few years, I think it's both top down as well as bottom up. In all honesty, I think if there's one saying which I think summarizes our approach over the last few years, it's been those who say it can't be done shouldn't interrupt those who are doing it.
I love that.
And I think, yeah, we are literally just getting on with it. And that's where I also feel, I mean, having come from Amazon in my prior role, which is most people would think of Amazon and innovation very, very much together. I will say, I mean, the culture we've established at First Bus for trying new things it's not just any rash decisions. It's still careful and calculated risks and venturing into new territories. I think if anyone really wants to see innovation and how we embed it, they should really come to First Bus and maybe not necessarily look at any other of the more well-established names.
I've just been sitting here thinking about you and your own career, and I've got the title already for this podcast. You've mentioned First Bus, you've mentioned Amazon, and it's got to be, surely, Faizan Ahmed delivers, because you deliver people, you've delivered parcels, and you're delivering change. It's just brilliant.
I think I'd be giving myself far too much credit if it was Faizan Emma delivers. I think it's not just my own team, but pretty much all of the functions across First Bus, who I'm fortunate to represent in various forums in terms of decarbonization. It's literally everyone all coming together.
Yeah, we mentioned We mentioned the H word, hydrogen, and I'm fascinated to understand you've got a background in hydrogen. Talk to us about hydrogen commercially, and how that may or may not play its part in decarbonisation.
Okay, I see you've done a very quick scan of the LinkedIn profile.
That's fair. That's fair. We have. Yeah.
So I think, well, to caveat, my background in hydrogen is for my master's thesis, I did some experimental work on hydrogen generation using aluminium nanoparticles. It's the very typical thing you sometimes see on YouTube videos, folks saying, oh, what's the energy crisis? Here's some aluminium cans and some normal regular sodium hydroxide, and look, we have plenty of hydrogen generated. So I kind of just did that at a little bit more of a industrial scale for university. Yeah. But look, from a transport perspective, as John's highlighted, yes, we've tried hydrogen. We've got a hydrogen fleet up in Aberdeen, 25 of them as well, still, I think. And I'm going off on a tangent here, but yeah, that Aberdeen facility we have, I think I've just glossed over, oh, we have 1,200 zero-emission vehicles. There's so many nuggets of interesting information here that at Aberdeen, it's probably the only only bus depot in the world which has hydrogen, diesel, new electric, and now as well as repowered electric buses as well. But anyway, I digress. On hydrogen, I think we've been there, done that, explored it at Aberdeen. And then we've also got a fleet near Sizewell as well of hydrogen buses, about four of them. But truth be told, given our operations, which are primarily mostly urban, and with the sizes of the batteries we're seeing and the opportunity, and no pun intended, the opportunities for opportunity charging during the day as well. I think we're technology agnostic, but based on the numbers and based on our use cases, we think it's in all likelihood going to be electric is primarily the way forward.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? This is the thing that has definitely surprised me from a couple of years ago. So probably 3 or 4 years ago, we were still in the world saying, you know, touting this group of buses up in Aberdeen and you know, dotted around the hydrogen buses. This was going to be the way forward. You know, this was going to solve the world's ills. And it was going to be the nirvana for truck. And it was going to, I mean, even people were talking, frankly, nonsense about it working in vans. I thought, I can't see it. I think electric has got vans. We're sorted. But when it went to truck and probably bus, maybe coach, I thought, yeah, do you know what? Hydrogen will come along and it'll solve some of the problems that electric can't solve. And then suddenly somebody came along and solved the problem with electric and batteries. And the challenge was charging. And yet you've managed to solve the problem of charging too. I'm really interested because it's incredibly exciting to see 1,200 buses and moving on from there, and the world's only depot in Aberdeen. And we welcome any nuggets that you wish to throw out across that story of 1,200 vehicles. But charging is proving the problem for the world, right, at the minute. The amount of energy, where the chargers are, being able to, you know, be productive. You seem to have solved that, but not only have you solved it for your own business, I think particularly of the site in Glasgow that that you've opened up now, and you're opening up more to share that infrastructure with other people at a very reasonable cost. So tell me why you guys have gone down that route and how it's working in practicality.
Yeah, in practicality. So before we come to sharing charging infrastructure, our own operations meant that depot-based charging infrastructure, charging the buses overnight, was the best choice. And so that's the route we went down. And when it comes to our own challenges over there, I think we have been very forward-thinking in terms of not necessarily waiting for the actual project before we secured power, because when most folks think of electrification, they think of the actual vehicle first, which is really the last thing which you should be thinking about. It's, well, the power upgrades which may be required, then the charging infrastructure, and then comes the vehicle. So I think that's the approach we've taken for ourselves. And I think there's that there is that saying as well, even when we're sharing charging infrastructure or when you're on the aeroplane, you know, put on your own oxygen mask first. So we've done that. And by virtue of our UK-wide operations, we've got 15 plus depots. And if I look at how many rapid charging stations we have, we are effectively with the, I think I quoted this at the presentation, right? The sixth or seventh largest rapid charging network in the country, which the largest rapid charging network you've never heard of, right?
Yeah.
So that's the context. And then this is what we primarily needed overnight. And during the day, the buses are out in service. We're transporting over 1 million people a day on our services. And we've also got all of this very, very useful infrastructure across the entire country not being used. And so it wasn't really rocket science. You're just trying to put two and two together over here as well. It helps us sweat our assets a little bit better. And then across our communities, there are various organizations who want to electrify but don't necessarily have the right charging infrastructure or access to it. And so it's just basically facilitating that marriage between our infrastructure and the folks who need to use it. And we started back in 2022 with the arrangement with DPD in Glasgow. And since then, it's just come along in leaps and bounds where we've got arrangements with various blue light companies, Centrica, Openreach, and in particular, lots of exciting developments with the EHGV space as well, which I know I highlighted earlier as well. So it's just the right thing to do is what I would say. And yeah, welcome any follow-ups.
And but the right thing to do, but at a price that really just blows everybody out of the water. I mean, I'm surprised you're not there with an orderly queue or a disorderly queue at the gates at the point when you open up the place, because 39 pence per kilowatt hour at your Glasgow site. I don't know whether it might differ from other sites and it might change over time, I know. But why have you gone so aggressive with that pricing?
I think that is the beauty of shared charging infrastructure, right? That we can afford to price very, very leanly. Because if you look at a regular public CPO, they will may have land leasing costs. They'll have insurance costs. They're going to have to recover the cost of the charging hardware, also a power upgrade, then insurances, charger operations and maintenance, and then the actual marginal cost of electricity. And then on top of that, any margin they need to be making. So when it comes to shared charging infrastructure, well, we can take away quite a few of that and effectively consider it paid for because, well, we needed to do that anyway for our buses. Not to say that there are additional costs which we have to consider just beyond the marginal cost of energy, but that just, I mean, it just really does allow us to be a little bit more competitive compared to perhaps your regular CPOs on the motorway. And right. I think it's just a win-win in many respects, right? It's good for the customer. And I think from our perspective as well, we do have these assets, which we can just, well, it just helps the overall electrification business case for us as well.
Let's pick that up, Faizan, because you mentioned customers, and I'm fascinated to understand whether customers actually care very much about whether they have an electric bus or a diesel bus, as long as they have a bus. Do you have evidence to the contrary that they do care very much?
I think it's early days, and I would echo the sentiment that whether it's electric or diesel, the most important thing is the bus should be on time and it should be reliable.
Yeah.
And that's basically absolutely true. And we've got, I mean, and we talk about first bus and decarbonization as that's the only thing we're doing. I think the entire company is transforming. We've got all kinds of initiatives, even on our networking and scheduling side, through which we're, thanks to the latest artificial intelligence scheduling software, we've already made massive improvements over there as well. So it's not just about big, shiny new electric buses. It's about really making sure it's electric buses. But then when we're putting on all of this investment, we're also making the necessary investments in our networking as well to make sure it's clean, but reliable and frequent as well.
That's really interesting. You mentioned AI just briefly there. We are holding a webinar later today, which will be totally irrelevant to anybody listening to this in 2 weeks' time. However, AI is playing an increasing part in delivering standard business services and escalating them, making them better, enhancing them for customers. Have you found that you're finding efficiencies that humans couldn't find?
I think this is a very good example where in the old world, a bus schedule might be set perhaps by manual means, by maybe just looking at clock faces, and that does work, and there is something to be said for, well, knowing that it's on the hour every hour or every 15 minutes. But if you have lots and lots of data and you know during a particularly busy time of the day that bus is going to be stuck in traffic and you're not really going to hit the 10:15, and you're better off just letting everyone know it's really going to be closer to 10:20. I think all of that data aggregation and making decisions, that's definitely one area where we have used AI. And therefore, what does that mean? It means more reliability on exactly when the bus is going to be coming across the board. Therefore, that's better for customers, better for drivers, and it's just a good virtuous circle overall.
Faizan, it's clear to me that, you know, you've got a really broad base of experience, right? Which, you know, for electrification, you've got some knowledge around hydrogen, you're exploring AI. I mean, you really are looking at the future in terms of, I think you've referred to it a couple of times, really looking further ahead by standing on the shoulders of great people in the past, you know, because you've got this privilege to stand in this place. What made you ever want to get on somebody's shoulders? Why do you care? What is the engine that says I need to look, I need to see, I know? How did this come about? What were you like as a kid in school? Where were you always sort of badgering the teacher for the next answer? What was it like?
Yeah, I think there's. I did go to university, and at universities you do have to write essays to get in. And I think I once started an essay that I've been described as the kind of person who's more interested in finding mistakes in the textbook than solving the problems in them. So I think that kind of curiosity and trying to peel away the layers and get to the crux of things, that's probably stuck with me, and it served me quite well, though, throughout my career, I would say.
Yeah.
Sure. But then of all the roles I've had, I have been in the sustainability and energy sustainability space prior to EVs as well. So I think I've always wanted to get out of bed every day to do something socially useful. And I've been very fortunate I've been very privileged that I have managed to stick to doing that. And I would say, and the one thing I do think about my current role as well is I didn't really need to be a decarbonization program director in the bus industry, because the bus industry, by the nature of what it does, public transport, whether it's diesel cars or EV cars you're taking off the road, it's already decarbonization without electric buses, if you think about it. And so, so much as when people think about decarbonization and they think about investments, really the biggest thing you can do is what we call in our industry, the lingo is modal shift. It is getting folks out of cars and onto public transport is perhaps the most important thing to be considering.
And I mean, where did this kind of sense of doing the right thing, wanting to get out of bed for something positive, come from? Is this to do with your upbringing? Is this just something in you, an engine in you that kind of wants to do something positive every day?
I don't know. It's quite a profound question. I just think if you are going to be doing something 8 to 10 hours a day or however long, it's probably a very good thing if you're driven and you're motivated and it's serving a broader purpose. And it doesn't have to be necessarily sustainability or electrification. I think folks can be driven, but this is, there might be a small minority who disagree, but by and large, I think sustainability, energy efficiency, renewables, electrification, they're generally good for society and the environment. And so I'm very happy and privileged to be making a career out of it as well. And I think whatever is good for the environment, I do firmly believe should be good for business as well.
Yeah, I think that has been something that I've noticed. And You mentioned that sort of good for business mentality and the investment in the future. And I mean, you've gone early with electrification, and 300 million is no small amount of money over a period of time. As a business model, how do you see this paying you back, and over what time period, and you know, how forward thinking are you being? Is it?
I think every company in electrification, whether it's vans, trucks, buses, and coaches, there is a spreadsheet somewhere created by finance, right? Which has upfront cost, savings. Traditionally, it's going to be, everyone knows it's going to be on the fuel, et cetera, et cetera. And then also on the operations and maintenance. So, and then in the bus, and then the bus industry, it doesn't really stop at 5 or 7 years as it might for others, whether it's leasing. It's literally going on to 15 or 20. And then at some point, yes, it's a spreadsheet and it gives you that sense of comfort that it's there in paper. But I think depending on what assumptions you take on that model, you may already be there in terms of total cost of ownership parity. But I think what's important is that there's a lot of uncertainty, and that it is literally about how optimistic you may be as a business and how forward thinking you are of whether those assumptions are going to play out. Whether it is, well, are we going to be hedging our energy costs in the right way, such as to make sure that we're not going to get caught out by another Ukraine war? Or do we really think these engineering costs are going to materialize because we've only got a small period of time there? So I think if there is any assistance required for businesses, it's a yes to meet any perceived gap, but it's also just the uncertainty premium. And that's where we as First Group, I think we're very, very First Bus and First Group, we're very bullish in our perspective. We think it's the right thing to do, and we think it makes good business sense, and that's what we're going to stick by. And so far, I think, yeah, based on initial experiences, yeah, we're continuing down this trajectory and going to continue to grow.
Brilliant.
One of the things, Faizan, we like to do is to get further beyond the job title and what you do in your business to discover a little bit about the human being behind all of that. And you strike me as somebody who is very, very driven and passionate about the things that you care about. What do you care about outside of work?
Do I care about outside of work? So I do have a 7-year-old son who's probably the most at a great age. So I think he's probably the one thing which takes up most of my time. Beyond that. Yeah. And then outside of work, I think key interests would be probably keeping myself fairly well and healthy. And I think that really just lends well to the job as well. And then beyond that, I think if there's one thing which is kind of been a constant in my life over the last few years, it's definitely a regular game of squash during the week, whether it's leagues or just friendlies.
Yeah, what have you learned from squash? Squash is hard, isn't it? It's hard on the bottom, if you don't mind me saying.
On the knees. What does it teach you,
Faizan?
Well, I think not just squash, probably all competitive sports. It is, in some respects, just a mini life experience as well, right? You realize it's, you can probably tell a lot about how a person is out in their regular life just by how they play squash as well. And so there's so much to say about your mental preparation and your body language and how you're really, you know, if you're not in the right frame of mind, regardless of how talented or skilled you are, you're probably not going to win that day. And then also, how do you come back from setbacks as well? Because you're not really going to win every game. Is it just a case of, well, going into a shell, or do you kind of, well, take it on the chin, learn what you can and say, you're not going to win all of them and come back another day? So I think in regular life during work, you're not really in such a pressure cooker environment all of the time as you might be on a small squash court where balls are hitting you all over the place. So I think it's just really good training.
Faizan, we've all got those war stories. Anybody that's played squash, of course, has always got the war story and have had to lift the left side of their shorts to show the black mark that's come from the squash ball on the left cheek. This honestly, squash can be brutal. I played for a while, and it does, honestly, it would absolutely tell you a lot about me if you saw me play squash. So I know the rules about getting to the tee. So if you get to the tee and you play from the tee, it's always better and calmer. Yeah, no, I'm the guy running at the wall at like 60 miles an hour and shoulder barging it just to keep upright. But I do love it, and I it's funny, there are games when I've won, you know, I don't know what the scoring mechanism is today, but it was sort of 9-9 at that point, and you only won on the service and all that sort of stuff. But I've won 9-0, I've won 9-1, and then two games later, you're losing 9-0 and you're losing 9-1. It's like, what is going on? And it's those moments you really hit the nail on the head in terms of setbacks, because how do we tackle setbacks? How do we kind of go into that? And there are days when I implode and I don't do well and I'm not so good. But there are other days where you just plow on through. What's a time where you've really encountered a big setback in life, in business? And how did you get through that, and what did you learn from that?
Oh, that's a deep question.
We do. That's what we like. We like a little bit of it, because people love people. And Faizan, you strike me as a really, and John's already touched on it, passionate, caring, you know, family person. But we learn from each other, and I just want to learn from somebody like you that has embraced the challenges of life, but no doubt felt some setbacks.
Yeah. I mean, I think if I look back career-wise, so originally a quick 1 minute summary is originally from Pakistan, but then went to the US for university, worked there a couple of years, then moved to the UK, kept my job. The same US job. So pre-COVID, I was still working remotely for over 3 years for a US company. And so I think in 2016, my wife and I decided we wanted to take a year off to go traveling. And that is what we ended up doing as well. And from an employment perspective, the master plan, which was all laid out, was that I may be returning to the US and my wife would be joining me also employed as well after that year of travel. And so that's how we basically planned our entire setup. We'd already left the country. We'd packed all our bags. We'd already moved some things to the US. But then as it turned out, after we'd left the UK, that actually just fell through in terms of moving to the US. So literally we were, I mean, in some respects, you can say, well, that doesn't sound like much of a setback, but
I think pretty big.
But yeah, we basically left one country with a view of maybe moving elsewhere, and then that future plan had fallen through. And so effectively we were just traveling the world for 1 year without necessarily having a view of the future, because that had all fallen through as well. And I think there was an approach of, well, oh, you know what, we should probably take this a little bit more seriously. We do need to be gainfully employed, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the way we approached it, and I will say we over here because it's not just myself, was,
yeah,
well, we'll worry about that when the time comes. We need to back ourselves. And so literally it was traveling around 17 or 19 countries without necessarily knowing, well, what's really going to happen when this all ends necessarily, and what country is it going to be? Because by virtue of, I mean, living in Pakistan, the US, the UK as well, we had ties to various places. And so, I mean, that's how we approached it. I mean, I think whenever you do have a setback, I think my one key thing I do always say is, well, there's no point worrying about things which aren't in your control, and just focus on what you can control. And the point was, let's just stay in the moment, and when the time comes, we'll make the best decisions as it happens. So I think, as it turned out, my wife was on a sabbatical officially in any case, so she did have something to come back to in the UK. On my end, I think it was August of 2017 when we returned. And yeah, didn't have any, well, formal clothes or anything, but I said, well, wife's got something over here. Let me take a stab for a few months, see how it all turns out. And then I was fortunate enough through a friend to get an interview at EDF as well.
Okay. Yeah.
And I do remember at that point, we still hadn't decided, is it going to be the UK? Is it going to be back to Pakistan? Is it going to be a third country? Because we could still get some work visas. And then I remember having to borrow my brother-in-law's socks and a tie and a vest and wearing an ill-fitted suit. But then apparently I got the interview. Within a month of having returned to the country, I was already gainfully employed. And so I think what that just taught me is minor setback, losing employment, but it's important to put things into perspective, live in the moment, and then not worry about things which are out of your control.
And what strikes me, Faizan, is that it speaks to a really brave side of you as well. Because I appreciate, like, for you and for your wife, it wasn't such a concern about employment, and yeah, you had a sort of backstop, but still, a lot of people would have gone, we've got to sort it out, and then we'll go and take the year out. You know, adjust the plan and then go. But you went, and I love that phrase, we backed ourselves. And that is something that many of us don't do, right? We worry that we're not going to get that next job, or, you know, redundancy. Redundancy can be a real hard knock for many people. But so often, such good things come from redundancy or job changes in general, you know, be they forced or be they chosen, and you make a mistake. But I love that. You back yourself.
And I think it is where I appreciate I do have a different perspective on some things. Folks have said, oh, you've been very brave to do this and this. And I don't mean this in any disrespect to anyone, but from my perspective, well, I think it's far braver to not want to do this and just be stuck in the same place for the next 20 years and wondering, well, what could have happened if I'd done it? I think that's some respects, that's
absolutely
braver. But then it's also the case of, I think you have to say, it's a privilege to be able to even have this choice. I know lots of folks have caring responsibilities. And so,
yeah,
I mean, I just happen to have the ability to go out and do some things and take some risks. And that's not everyone can do that. And I appreciate that.
Viva la adventure, or whatever. I don't know, whatever it is.
Yeah, yes. That. Bit of Spanish for no apparent reason. Faizan, you are somebody who uses words to create pictures. You're a very clever communicator. You talked about charger sharing, and it's a bit like when the mask drops down on a plane. You have to do yours first. It creates an image. And I'm struck by the fact that a number of times you've used a phrase or a saying which clearly is part of your DNA. You absorb these things and you hold on to them. What's the best piece of advice that's almost central to who you are that you've ever been given, whether it's business or personal?
Best piece of advice? I mean, I am definitely a collector of quotes as well. But I think in the spirit of innovation and the topic at hand, I might not have shared this at the transport forum, Paul, but I think one of Jeff Bezos's quotes from a corporate perspective always has stayed with me. And he was asking, I mean, in his annual letters, he did, one of his questions was, are our failures big enough? Because you have to accept that you're going to be failing, but are the scale of our failures big enough that we're moving the needle? So, yeah. And when you're really working in large organizations, I think that's just a tremendous approach and a mindset to have that, look, you are going to probably fail when you're going to try new things. And the question isn't whether you're going to fail. You even need to ask yourself, well, are the failures big enough relative to my size of operations? Is a really good kind of quote, which has kind of stuck with me as well. And dare I say, I think it's it's not something to take glibly. I mean, there are good failures and bad failures. When it comes to failures, it's not about rash decisions or ignoring health and safety, none of that, but just in the spirit of going into the unknown. And when there's a lot of uncertainty, you got to accept that some things aren't going to go your way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know we've sort of touched on it a little bit, but have you noticed areas of life where that has occurred? I've got to ask, haven't I? You know, what is your biggest failure?
I think if you have a growth mindset, you always think when life gives you lemons, make lemonade and look in the bright side. But so I think within the context of work then and the context of shared charging infrastructure, I know we've outlined various models of how we can do it. For instance, in one instance, if you have a bus depot and you've got your own charging infrastructure, well, you've already built your transformer, you've already got feeder panels, why don't you install charging infrastructure just outside the depot walls? And you could also call that sharing because you're still sharing some aspects. I think we have tried out that model as well right now at First Bus at a depot in Cornwall. And if I think about it, yes, that is one means of sharing, but the reality is maybe that wasn't where we should have been focusing all of our efforts, because we've got all of this charging infrastructure inside the depots, which is really what we should be innovating for and seeing, well, what changes do we need to make sure all of that is accessible, as opposed to putting yet more investment outside the depot. And so that's yielded fruit, because all of a sudden then that is literally a financial investment, which then means you do need to deliver returns. And then in the case of our depots, what happens if 3 or 4 other superchargers are installed down the road, and then all of a sudden your business case is entirely eroded? So if you're looking for an example of, well, we tried something new and we absolutely should have done what we did and we've taken a lot of lessons from that, I think that's one good example of maybe that's not the best approach for shared charging infrastructure.
Brilliant. And I'd say, because many people are considering exactly that. You know, do we put some stuff outside of the wire, some stuff inside of the wire, just to be, but better to overcome the health and safety, the accessibility, the process that you have to do to open up your depot, rather than just stick random chargers outside of the wire, and then hope that the commercial value will be realized of those dedicated shared chargers.
The thing about good strategy and, oh yeah, that makes sense, it always looks great in hindsight, right? And now it does make sense. Oh yeah, we should have been focusing on primarily shared infrastructure where we've already got the chargers. But absolutely, when you're starting out and you're trying out different models, I think that was definitely a very worthwhile approach to take. And I have to say that everything we learned from that experience, it has then informed what we've done at other sites as well, where at Glasgow in Caledonia, for instance, where we have not just for businesses, that's the one unique side where we've basically reconfigured the depot such that it's open to the public as well. Had we not done the Cornwall example, Glasgow would never really have happened as well as it did.
Wow. As well. It's great, isn't it? Really, really cool to sort of see this whole mindset coming to life, the you know, this development coming to life. It's brilliant. Now, we have a closing tradition, Faizan, on the EV Cafe. I mean, any podcast worth its salt has a closing tradition, right? We could all think of, you know, lesser podcasts than ours, but, you know, that have these things. We have one. And I think this is going to help you immensely, because it is the EV Cafe magic wand. And you can see it's the EV Cafe one because it's got the little lightning bolt here, straight from what's that fella's name? Harry, that's him. Harry Potter. So we're gonna pass you the magic wand. So here it comes. Ooh. it's going into your control. There you go. That's it. You've got it. Absolutely. And so now you hold the magic wand and you get one wish with the magic wand. And, you know, taking it from the context of you wanting to kind of continue to make that difference and to do all of the things that you're setting out to do, what would you wish for, Faizan? What? How would you use your power?
How would I use my power? Well, I think I'll restrict scope over here again to shared charging infrastructure, because it's easy as well. I mean, to think of a few things there. I think for the benefit of customers, as well as for the benefit of shared charging infrastructure providers or just regular charging infrastructure providers, I do think if there was one big global map or global platform to rule them all, regardless of whether it's on one network or the other network, such that there was just this perfect meeting point of someone who needs charging knows exactly where they can go to get charging. I think, and I know it's coming, I don't know who's going to be providing it, but I think that would be a very, very good thing for the industry in the next few years. Months, to be ambitious, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really, really important kind of thing. Because there's different apps, different maps, different, but yeah, just for somebody to be able to kind of go, you know, where is it? There I can go, and that's my cost, and that's how I access it.
Yeah, and all it's at the point of, I mean, and it's good for the public charging network, but now we're getting to shared charging, and then, yeah, I think there's some providers who might not have certain charge points because they're still not on their aggregated network as well, so you almost needed an aggregator of an aggregator. And then if everyone buys into that platform, and then that's also used potentially for booking chargers, I think it's going to be great, because once you get into bookings, then that increases a fixed utilization and a fixed rate of return, then the cost can come down as well, and then it's just going to be happy days for the entire industry.
Does that kind of feel a little bit like an Uber app, something like that? That sort of scale of kind of bringing, and I know we've got the traditional private hire world that kind of goes over, but I do see more and more taxis turning up, the traditional taxis turning up when Uber, you Uber somewhere. It's like they're kind of having to kind of go into that funnel.
Yeah, agreed. And obviously we have agreements with, and we're working on agreements with various of the roaming partners in the industry as well. But there is still a gap, I think, especially as the EHGV industry is picking up as well. And they're also developing their own shared charging initiatives. There's still that, well, where is this all going to come together, guys?
Yeah. So I said a closing tradition, right? Which sort of sends it's almost the end, but I wanted to ask a question about BESS and solar, battery energy storage systems, for those that don't know the acronym, and solar. And is this something that you already invested in and using to kind of, we talked about that control of the power, didn't we? You know, that the power of pricing not being affected by outside circumstances. Is that something that you're beginning to look at? Is it something you've already looked at and have rolled out extensively? How does BESS and solar, battery energy storage and solar energy, affect or is being used in First Bus?
It's a great question. So on rooftop solar, we've already rolled that out extensively wherever we can. About 25 depots already have rooftop solar on them out of our 60 depots.
Right.
Battery energy storage is a very interesting question, because I've been thinking far ahead. We've got lots and lots of lithium ion, and we have an ownership position in all of our batteries across all of our buses. And we do see, once the battery warranty is over and it's past its lifetime, what is that second life going to be and what are those opportunities? And grid scale battery storage to help support the rest of the energy transition, because as you get more wind and solar at grid scale, you also need battery storage to store all of that. So we absolutely see that as a very important use case. And so to that end, we've already got a couple of projects in the works to already install grid scale, well, to already install stationary storage at our depots, with a view that, again, we're trying how this works right now, with a view that, well, you know what, we're going to have potentially 3,000 bus batteries, which are going to be need to put to a second life use over the course of the next 5 or 10 years. So it's an area where we need to start exploring and understand how it all works. And so we do see that as very important.
And do you see that linking in to vehicle to grid type of, you know, almost energy trading? I mean, in your situation with the grid scale batteries that you'll end up with just by fact that you've got all these buses, does that, you know, I guess that's sort of part of the financial model that many of us don't really consider, me included, and also very hard to define at the moment. Do you see that as sort of another thing that will help drive the commercial model?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think vehicle to grid, you can almost say there's a stepping stone to get there as well. So where you start off with is you have chargers and you have buses and you charge them whenever the bus comes in. That's level one. Next level is you're a little bit more intelligent about when you charge them because you know it's cheaper overnight. And you're also then load managing your power to basically split it across buses. I would call that level two on the stepping stone. Level three is what I would call V1G almost, as in it's just one way where you're looking at your grid prices every day and making a new decision based on exactly when you can charge your buses while still optimizing everything. I think that's where we're at right now as well. And that's still with the energy markets. And then next steps is, well, just beyond buying and selling energy, you need to support the grid. And then this is where all of my EDF background comes in quite handy as well, is that you've got capacity market services such that when the grid is under stress and it needs to, well, maybe call on loads to reduce, a whole bunch of buses charging overnight. If you have enough of a buffer, stopping charging for half an hour means you can offer the grid quite significant support. We've already got capacity market agreements in place as well. And I think, so we're quite a ways already on that journey, but to get to V2G, well, then you need the bus manufacturers on board. Then you also need the right charging. And then you're at that point where is the juice worth the squeeze? As it turns out right now, it's questionable, but we're there, we're waiting, and we're already future-proofing ourselves. So as and when that case is going to happen. Yeah.
Great. Good to know. John.
Isn't he good?
He
and I tell you why. Back in the day when I worked for the Scottish government, I always fretted about inequality and that electric vehicles are for those who have lots of readies and they can afford to make that contribution to their lives. They can afford clean air. They can afford. It's a middle class, middle England vehicle. And I'm delighted to say that in Scotland, we have something called the Just Transition, where nobody gets left behind in the decarbonisation of transport. So the policies are in place to make sure everybody benefits from clean air, clean energy, better transport systems. And I'm delighted that Faizan sits in the seat he does, because I get a sense of a solid human being who's doing a very, very important job quietly, just getting on with it, but making massive inroads and helping everybody in Scotland to have a better transport system. You deserve all the plaudits that we can give you and many, many more. You're superb.
Yeah, thank you. I think just a couple of points there. One is, I mean, over the course of the last couple of years, I've learned a ton. I wasn't a bus industry person before, but I think, and I can't claim credit for this quote, but it is very, very important to just think of public transport when you think of decarbonization as well, because otherwise the saying is all you're going to be left with are clean and quiet traffic jams. So it's not just about, that's where the whole modal shift aspect comes in.
True.
And then on everything else, I mean, look, I'm just the face of the program. It's full credit to the First Bus leadership team, everyone, all of our engineers, all of our drivers. I think definitely a call out to our construction team as well, because very quietly, if you're talking about a team which is very quietly just getting on with it, building the largest rapid charging network you've never heard of in the span of 3 or 4 years, I think that's quite an accomplishment. And just beyond First Bus, well, really all of the partners we're working with as well. So,
one of our team, Sam Clark, has this saying. He says, "Don't tell me what you're going to do. Tell me what you've done. You've done it. Well done."
Well, I'm the phrase I'm walking away from today, and Faizan, you are, I noted this when you presented, you are a font of many phrases and sayings, but I love that saying, well, the people that say that you can't do it, stop interrupting those of us that are doing it.
Yeah. Just, might be using that ourselves.
That's absolutely. It's been brilliant. Faizan, it's been really encouraging to hear an organisation, and forgive John, he lives in Scotland. He only thinks Scotland, but the rest of the country is also covered by First Bus, of course.
Whatever.
It's like me with vans. What? There's other vehicles? But what's clear is that you guys are... the biggest charging point operator that we've never heard of, but now hopefully a few more people have heard of us or heard of you, and as the sites become open and available, and I'm sure they'll hit various maps and apps and whatever for people to be able to access, but 39 pence a kilowatt hour, if you're in the region of Glasgow and you can do that, and your Openreach, Centrica, DPD, and you know, any number of other organisations, whilst public charging is not ideal for those circumstances, because productivity is critical, right? You wouldn't stop your bus to charge it for an hour typically, because obviously everybody will be waiting and upset. Well, it's the same in the van world, you know. So if you're charging those vans, but it is a tremendous thing that First Bus are doing across the nation. And really, really encouraging, and also a very, very reasonable price, which makes that charging much more accessible financially to many people. So small businesses, your butcher, your baker, your candlestick maker, all able to kind of pop in to the local bus depot and get charged up. I mean, that's cool.
Yeah, and outside of Caledonia, where we've opened it to the public, I mean, the proposition across the other sites is still by invitation with select businesses. And I think, the pricing, beyond the pricing structure, I think what we found is, particularly with blue lights organizations as well, it's the availability. We have lots and lots of bays. The size, we can accommodate large vehicles, which maybe public charging can't. And then really the security as well, because some of these vehicles have inventory as well. And so I think you put all of this together, and it's a very compelling proposition. And that's what we found in the market as well. Yeah.
What a great
way
to
anyone
end.
Listening, welcome any conversations. You can go to, I have to do a shameless plug. We have rebranded it as First Charge. So you're welcome to go to firstcharge.co.uk and reach out.
Well, the great news is, Faizan, that will be into the show notes, I think they call them these days.
Okay.
the clever people. So we'll pop that firstcharge.co.uk into the post. Obviously follow Faizan on LinkedIn, and you know, connect with him there, connect with First Bus on LinkedIn as well, and just is First Charge on LinkedIn, is that a showcase page? Have you got one of those?
Well, that's a very good question. Not quite just yet, but we'll probably get there.
Okay, well, yeah. We'll provide a little bit of consultancy to your teams, and we'll help you with that. But it's been a real joy, Faizan. Thank you so much for taking the time today, and for really helping us understand some really valuable shared charging, but also the great mission that First Bus are on, and the great mission that you're on, to make a difference and to leave something better behind. And you're definitely doing that for sure. And we're really grateful. So check out all the other podcasts, everybody. You know where to find them at evcafe.org. You can also find them on those Apple and Spotify and all of that sort of good stuff. But everything can be found on evcafe.org. You can find your next new vehicle from there too, be it a car or a van. Yes, absolutely. So leasing.com, providing the best value vehicles there. So go and check that out as well. So many things, so many time, so much... So many things and so little time. That's what I was going to say. Anyway, check out our website, check out the other podcasts. It's fabulous. And connect with Faizan in all the ways that are in the show notes right now. So have a great day, everybody. And we look forward to seeing you next time.